Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from RE/MAX Realty Associates, currently handling over 30% of the real estate sales transactions in Champaign County. Information at 352-5700. RE/MAX encourages you to join them in supporting public broadcasting.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. Since it became independent in 1980, the country of Zimbabwe, formerly known as Rhodesia, has been controlled by just one political party, ZANU-PF, and one man has led the government there, Robert Mugabe. He as the first prime minister. He later served as president. In 2002, he was elected to a fifth term as president in an election where independent observers charged widespread fraud. Mr. Mugabe continues to face a great deal of criticism, even though at one time he would have been regarded as a revolutionary hero. But today he has critics both inside Africa and outside as well, in Europe, in Britain, in the United States. He's been criticized both for the ruthless way that he's dealt with his political opponents and also for the way he has managed the economy. 80% of Zimbabweans are unemployed. Inflation there is running at more than 1,000%. The country was at one time an exporter of food, yet since June of 2002, Zimbabwe has been dependent on food aid from outside of the country. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about Zimbabwe, about its present, perhaps speculating on its future, and talking about Mr. Mugabe. And our guest for the program is Scott Taylor. He is assistant professor in the African Studies program of the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And his interests in research and teaching lie in the areas of African politics and political economy, with particular emphasis on the Southern African region. He has held positions as senior political advisor for the Carter Center's democracy program in Southern Africa. He was visiting research associate at the Department of Political and Administrative Studies at the University of Zimbabwe and also at the Institute for African Studies in Zambia, and he has also served as an election observer in several African countries. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, as always, questions from people who are listening are welcome. The only thing we just ask of callers is that people try to be brief and help us move along, get in as many different callers as possible. But anyone's welcome to join the conversation. Here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. At any point here, if you want to join the conversation, you may call us. Professor Taylor, hello.
Yes.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, we appreciate you giving us your time. I think that a lot of people would argue that if you are going to try to understand Robert Mugabe, what you have to do is go back and talk about and try to understand this guerrilla war that he was involved in the 1970s against the white rulers of the country. Maybe we can start there, and you can just sort of give us a thumbnail sketch about Mr. Mugabe and his revolutionary roots.
Well, Mugabe began, rose to leadership of the party in the 1970s, was always a leader among the leadership in ZANU, was then called ZANU before it was renamed ZANU-PF. In the 1960s, after its founding, and into the 1970s, when he became its head, Mugabe had a profile of a African socialist, was very steeped in Marxist rhetoric, and sort of proposed a Marxist regime for the country, which he hoped to install after this long liberation struggle, which consisted of a struggle that began really, the first shots began in about 1966, but the hot war, if you will, didn't really accelerate until 1972, and the peak period of that conflict was from 72 to 1979. And Mugabe became the leader of the ZANU faction. There was another large faction called ZAPU, the Zimbabwe African People's Union. And Mugabe, surprisingly to everyone, won the elections in 1980, defeating both the Rhodesia Front, or successor party and ZAPU, and Mugabe became first prime minister. The interesting thing about him was that he did not institute the Afro-Marxist regime that he had perhaps aspired to, and instead embraced, to a large degree, the existing socio-political setup, which was preserving the dominance of white capitalism, appealing to white farmers and business people to remain in the country, and initially, at least vis-a-vis economically and vis-a-vis his former opponents in the war, the white-led party and former colonial government, he was fairly pursued a policy of appeasement to a considerable degree. People who have done biographies of Mugabe have speculated quite a bit on that he never really he never forgave the whites. There's speculation that he was tortured when he was imprisoned in the 1960s. That he's always harbored these resentments and has tried to exact his revenge upon that population. But whether or not that's true, this initial period from the 1980s up until really the mid 1990s was one of accommodation of his former of the former adversaries, particularly of the whites. Although, and we can get into it later in the discussion, he did have quite a bit of friction with his former comrades in arms in the ZAPU wing of the independence movement.
Well, I guess that invites the question about, well, it certainly invites the question about why it is he's taken this turn that he has in recent years. But just to step back a little bit, I think also for those people who would say, well, you want to understand this man, you've got to understand the struggle that took place back then.
Right.
The other thing that I think that people would say is that Mr. Mugabe, perhaps like other kinds of revolutionary leaders, perhaps had the qualities that it took to win the revolution.
To lead the revolution, but not to govern.
That's right. And that we can point through history, we can point to many, many cases when that was true, that you need a different kind of leadership to win the war than you do actually to govern, and that his ideology, his way of working, he never was able to make that transition from revolutionary leader to a kind of stable peacetime governor.
Well, I'm hesitant to, you know, and I know some callers, I'm sure, have a response to this. I am hesitant to personalize everything within the individual of Mugabe, to say that Zimbabwe's current crisis, the absolute collapse that you indicated in your opening about the statistics and the utter meltdown of the economy, the political situation, the social situation. Mugabe is certainly instrumental in that, but as you point out, I mean, we really do need to be aware of this larger history, the history of struggle, the very violent civil war that took place there in the 1970s, the residual effects from that, in many ways, the economic demands from Zimbabwe's black population, which were never addressed, and the fault lies both with Mugabe and with his opponents on the other side in that one. But then if you look at the period of the 1980s, Mugabe comes to power in April 1980 and was relatively quickly sort of established, you know, sort of political control and hegemony over the country. But for the most part, and there are some very notable exceptions even in the 1980s, but for the most part, from 1980 until around about, I mean, I would date it from 1997, from 1980, for 17 years, the country was fairly stable. And in fact, we in the West and elsewhere were still talking about Zimbabwe as, you know, being the breadbasket of Southern Africa, being a relatively industrialized economy, a relatively stable economy. So I might differ with the assessment that that Mugabe couldn't govern at all for that period. He, you know, he surrounded himself with some capable people, including a very capable minister of finance in the 1980s and into the early 1990s. And so what we see then, the catalyst, as I see it, it was in 1997 when he started facing emergent political threats, and that's when, if you will, we see the radical acceleration of the racist rhetoric, of the farm seizure rhetoric, of demonizing to a degree that he had not done before, or to an extent, rather, that he had not done before, of the white population and so on. So, again, I think, yes, Mugabe, we can point a lot of fingers at him, and certainly the current crisis seems to be centered around him, but I dare say that the full scope of history is greater than Mugabe, and I think that if we concentrate too centrally on Mugabe himself, we're risking saying, well, once Mugabe's gone, everything good will return to Zimbabwe, and I, unfortunately, am more skeptical than that. Mm.
Very quickly, let me introduce again our guest, Scott Taylor. He is assistant professor in African studies at the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. We're talking about Zimbabwe. And questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. It seems to me that an awful lot of the conflict and a lot of the economic problems that Zimbabwe is facing now goes back to a core issue that perhaps was never really very well resolved, and maybe the reason was that is an extremely difficult issue to resolve, and that is, how do you go from a kind of society where a minority controls everything, they hold the best land, they're the elites, they're the ones that run things, to a place where you have a more equitable division, and you start to parcel out the good stuff that previously had been controlled by and held by the minority, and parcel that out so that everybody gets a little piece. And here the sort of the central issue is land reform. Mm-hmm. And how it is you do that. There was a time when there had been this commitment of the government that said, we'll pay for the land. This is going to be a fair exchange. It'll be willing seller. We won't force anybody off their land, but we want to move to this point where we can redistribute and get land more into the hands of more people, and certainly into the hands of black Zimbabweans. Well, that couldn't work, but it didn't work, and then we get to this point where the government has taken this position that they're just going to take the land.
Well, yes, I mean the whole thing has. The process of land reform in Zimbabwe, and there's been a tremendous amount of research, excellent work on this, but the process of land reform in Zimbabwe went through several phases. I think we can all agree that, except for representatives of the Zimbabwean government, that the process that's gone on since 2000 has been almost hopelessly corrupted, that it has been a way of rewarding elites within the ruling party, a system of patronage. Basically, land was forcibly seized from many or mostly white commercial farmers, but also black commercial farmers, and reallocated to party hacks and political officials. As a system of rewards and patronage. But again, the long scope of history on that issue is that Mugabe, the war was very much about land and about access to the land, and there were very restrictive rights to the land, and certainly the best farmland in Zimbabwe under first the colonial government and then under the Rhodesia Front government from 1965. So where blacks were proscribed from owning quality farmlands, and whites held a very small population, about 6,000 whites, and by 1980 held 50% of the land in Zimbabwe, and this was obviously untenable. So in many respects, the war was about this. Now, the compromise reached at the Lancaster House talks in London in 1979 required the government to abide by this agreement by which land would not be forcibly seized. And there were pledges from the United States and from Great Britain to help in the land reform process. But it proceeded very, very slowly in the 1980s. By 1983, I think the number was 53,000 families had been resettled, and the plan was to go at least three times that. And then after that period, it pretty much, the process just stalled. The Lancaster House Agreement expired in 1990, which presumably gave the government then a free hand to do what it would with land acquisition, and passed in 1992 a new Land Acquisition Act, which gave the government the right to acquire farms with a deferred payment, basically a deferred payment scheme. And nothing was done under this plan either. So you do start to question whether or not the ZANU-PF leadership, many of whom owned commercial farms even at that time, were not comfortable with the status quo, despite the land hungriness of the Zimbabwean mass population, that the status quo, even post-Lancaster, post-1990, was acceptable. And in fact, nothing happened, despite the passage of the Land Acquisition Act in 1992. Really, nothing happened on land between 1992 and 2000. 1997, Mugabe accelerated the rhetoric about land, but again, even after 1997, nothing happened until 3 years later. So it was really 10 years after the expiration of Lancaster before the government suddenly said, wait, we've got to do something about the land. And I would argue that it had to do everything to do with political expediency and the survival of the regime, and very little to do with equity and the genuine land hunger that existed in Zimbabwe and still is pervasive in the country.
Yeah. We have a caller here. I tell you what, rather than asking a follow-up, I'll just go ahead. I don't want to keep them waiting too much longer. We'll talk with them in Champaign County. It's line number one. Hello.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually calling about the Lancaster House Accords, and you mentioned that the U.S. agreed to help with it. You also mentioned that Mugabe was actually a surprise in the first days that he didn't institute some kind of revolutionary program. The kind of commitments the U.S. made, I'm not quite sure of, but the U.K. was supposed to, being the colonial previous, not official, but sort of the colonial power, and having Anglo gold and et cetera. I mean, basically, they were the people that benefited from Zimbabwe's resources for so long. They had a commitment to help fund a land reform, and that the amazing story is that Mugabe didn't pursue this kind of money. Maybe he knew that Thatcher and then Major wouldn't do it, but he seems like he would have at least kept lines open. And it seems to me that the betrayal of maybe on both sides of pursuing a real land reform, as had been sort of envisioned in the Lancaster House Accords, I don't know if they would have gone sufficient to the as you described it, the really lopsided land tenure.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted you to expand on that, because that seems to be the thing when Mugabe is made out to be such a monster. I mean, he wasn't doing a lot for his people when he was getting along with the Reagan and Thatcher and in the first days, and didn't pursue the kind of promises that were made.
Right.
That seems to me that that's where discussions about Zimbabwe should start instead of at Z.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the question. That really was where I would have gone myself to ask this question about what would the failure of the particularly Britain, but maybe also the United States to follow through on commitments to try to assist in land reform. Would that if the U.S. and the U.K. particularly had been in there, would that have made any difference?
Well, it's difficult to say, and there's a lot of argument back and forth about this issue and who pledged what and whose fault it was that there wasn't this sufficient follow-up and so on. The United States was sort of hamstrung by the change in government. The Carter administration allegedly made certain pledges for assisting in land reform. And then these were disavowed by the Reagan administration when the change took place right around the same time. And you know, if you talk to sort of ZANU-PF leaders from that time, they say that, you know, we were let down by the United States, and the United States refused to participate in the land reform exercise. The British one is a little bit more controversial because the Brits say that, you know, well, we had this fund and I've forgotten the precise amount of money that was supposed to be available for land reform. And as the caller said, the British alleged that this was never drawn down and that it was never accessed, and the issue was sort of you know, not followed up with. And then if you look at Mugabe's relationship with the Labour Party government in Great Britain, it's been absolutely disastrous where, you know, especially from the beginning and to some extent now, he heaps everything at the fault of Great Britain and says, you know, well, Great Britain double-crossed us. First they hamstrung us with Lancaster, then they didn't follow through on their commitments for land reform. So it's not really clear where the sort of the fault per se lies. But what is true is what the caller pointed out, is that there seemed to be a great deal of satisfaction, if I can use that word, with this prevailing status quo in the mid-1980s all the way through, that, you know, this relatively small number of predominantly white farmers, then about 4,000 plus, 4,500, would remain on the land and farm indefinitely without harassment, and that this was, you know, all indications were that this was acceptable, despite the occasional political rhetoric the other way. So, I mean, Mugabe loves to demonize the British and loves to blame the British, and surely some, you know, pledges were made that weren't followed up. It's just a little bit ambiguous as to, you know, ultimately where the fault lies.
Hmm. Just real quick, does that get at your question, Colin?
Yeah, it does. I had forgotten about the fact that Reagan came in just as those were being, just as the invisible ink was fading away, I guess.
And the Reagan administration, of course, had a very different relationship with Southern Africa, and particularly with the liberation movement, than did the Carter administration.
Yeah, constructive engagement with apartheid and Cheney's famous lack of a vote in favor of the release of Nelson Mandela, contemporizing it. How much tobacco is grown in Zimbabwe now, for a completely different sort of question, and non-food crops, sort of the cash crop IMF kind of prescription.
Crop has fallen considerably. Simply because, you know, tobacco was largely a commercially farmed crop. And so the output has shrunk, and Zimbabwe was the second largest exporter in the world and one of the top three producers. It's still producing a significant amount of tobacco. It's now about the sixth or something largest. And it's still growing cotton, which was always in good rain years. Cotton was the major, was predominantly produced by small scale farmers. So that is still being grown to some degree, but otherwise the agricultural production, particularly of food crops, has collapsed. David indicated in the opening, is one of the major reasons why now Zimbabwe is a net food importer.
Well, I want to thank the caller and go on to someone else here who is holding on. Maybe I also should introduce again our guest just very quickly, Scott Taylor. He is assistant professor in the African Studies program of the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University, and does research and teaching in the areas of African politics and political economy, particularly with emphasis on the Southern African region. And we are talking about Zimbabwe. We have a caller here in Chicago. We'll get right to the number, by the way, if you'd like to call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Chicago in line four. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen. How you doing?
Good.
Fine, thank you.
Good. I hope this thing don't break up this cell phone so we haven't made it all the way yet. But anyway, okay, speaking of Zimbabwe, and I'm glad you brought up the Lancaster Agreement and all of that. During that period of the 1980s with Margaret Thatcher transitioning out of Carter to Ronald Reagan. But, you know, it seems like you're putting all the blame internally. But there has been, from my reading, a lot of external forces messing around in Zimbabwe, as well as that whole southern region there, mm-hmm. which is causing a lot of instability. And this is what President Mugabe seemed to be always referring to. I mean, how much credence do you give to that?
In the 1980s, you mean, in particular?
Well, I'm talking about right now, even.
Well, I mean, as far as the 1980s, I would say that you're absolutely right, and that's something that, you know, should be highlighted, the level of external intervention, particularly from apartheid-ruled South Africa at the time, destabilizing Zimbabwe. As far as now, the external interference, if you will, in Zimbabwe, I'm not really, if I understand the question correctly, I would say that the influence of external actors on Zimbabwe right now is minimal, notwithstanding the recent threat by the IMF to revoke Zimbabwe's membership, which was hastily sort of paid off and settled in February of this year. But the notion that sort of that. If I understand the question correctly, that the government is sort of under siege from outside, and that, you know, there are hostile forces both in the region and in the international financial institutions and in the U.S. and the U.K. and the EU in particular. I think there's some credence to that, and there has been a great deal of hostility, even animosity between. The British, in particular, and Zimbabwe, and there's been, and Condoleezza Rice called Zimbabwe recently one of the outposts of tyranny. But as far as the impact on the ground of that, it's in terms of the influencing the leadership, other than making them dig in their heels, I don't see where that's. Where they've been sort of pressured to do anything.
Okay, well, one last question. And wasn't that just a group of mercenaries within the last year, give or take, that was arrested there in Zimbabwe?
Yeah, but those were mercenaries who were allegedly trying to overthrow the government of Guinea, who were traveling through. Zimbabwe and dealing with arms through Zimbabwe, and the Zimbabweans arrested them. But there have been a number of other plots that have been alleged of ingrown or domestic groups that are alleged to be interested in overthrowing the government. And there are occasionally rumors of their foreign-backed and so forth. But as far as I can tell at this point, that none of those have had any validity.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Back in 2000 in Zimbabwe, there was a referendum held on some changes to the constitution, or on a new constitution. And among other things, it would introduce term limits for the president. It would have made government officials immune from prosecution for anything they did illegal while they were in office. It also would allow the government to confiscate white-owned land without compensation. And it was a great surprise, I think, and also a great embarrassment to the ruling party, ZANU-PF, that this was defeated. The new constitution was defeated. And they were concerned about parliamentary elections that were coming up just in a couple of months. And then it was only 2 years later that Mr. Mugabe won his fifth term as president in this election that I think was widely considered to be illegitimate. So all that would argue that maybe what has been happening over the last few years, it can be explained simply as people in the ruling party being concerned about their grip on power, about the strength of the opposition, particularly the Movement for Democratic Change. It's led by Mr. Tsvangirai, and that it's simply a matter of trying to hold on to power.
Well, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, it's not, but it's hardly simple. but it does come down to power. I mean, and that's why you know, I and others date the sort of the origins of this crisis of the collapse, really, to 1997, which was actually the MDC didn't emerge until September 1999 as a party. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, one of its major legs of the MDC is the labor union, which was beginning to amass some power and look like a credible political threat, as well as the war veterans group, which had always been a ZANU-PF supporter. And in 1997, they started making noises over unpaid pensions and the fact that the pension fund for war veterans had been looted and making demands on the regime. And Mugabe had to capitulate. And really, from that time in late 1997 is when, you know, I would date the beginnings of this crisis. Then by the time you see 1999 comes along and the establishment of the Movement for Democratic Change, you see a party that has a very strong labor base, a very strong urban, the disaffected urban voters had flocked to MDC, and most of the business community, including the large-scale, predominantly white commercial farmers. So the MDC emerged as a potentially economically powerful and certainly politically powerful opposition movement, which looked prepared to sweep control of the parliament in June 2000 elections. And, of course, they got 57 seats, and there was certainly fraud in the election, they did not secure enough for a majority, and they have been embattled, to say the least, ever since. And as you point out, the defeat of that referendum, which was floated by the ruling party in February 2000, it was a wake-up call for the regime that we are vulnerable. And you're absolutely right that everything since that point has been about trying to break this opposition, and they've done a very good job of undermining the MDC. It still has great potential, but it's not nearly as formidable as it once was. And the ruling party has done, if it's done one thing well, breaking the back of the MDC and the opposition and the populace at large, I would argue, in Zimbabwe, it has been successful at doing that, and in the process has consolidated power.
Hmm. Mr. Mugabe is 82, I believe that's correct. Apparently there are, maybe more than recently, there have been frequent rumors about his health, and occasionally there was a rumor that he had died. And he, of course, got to come out and say, no, the rumors of my death are greatly exaggerated, and I'm going to be around for a while. Although he's also said that at some time in the relative near future, it was his intention to retire. You said earlier in the conversation that there are some people who think that and that we concentrate maybe too much on Mr. Mugabe himself, to the point that there are some people who say that, well, when he passes, that day, so someday will come when he passes, everything will be fine. Well, I think you're clearly implying that no, that everything will not be fine, and perhaps things won't change very much. When Mr. Mugabe is gone, what's going to happen?
Well, this is the $64,000 question, or in Zimbabwean currency, that's about $6 billion question. It's really unclear. I mean, the Mugabe, again, there, as you say, the rumors of his demise have been going on for years now. I had the chance to meet with him myself a few years back, and at that time he was rumored to be ill, and he was rumored to have no longer be lucid, and so on. And you know, none of that was true. I don't know these rumors periodically float. He has indicated for the first time, I think it was last year, 2004, that he was interested in stepping down. So, as you say, he'll either step down voluntarily or at some point he'll pass away, and then you're left with a succession. It's not clear what happens under the current constitution if he were to leave office or die in office. A new election for president is supposed to be held within 90 days. They are trying currently to change the constitution, and they have a supermajority in both the assembly, the National Assembly, and the new Senate, which was inaugurated last year. They can certainly change the constitution without much problem at this point. That would allow him to appoint a successor, an interim president, and they want to reconcile. In Zimbabwe, the presidential and legislative elections are staggered. Legislative term is 5 years and presidential is 6 years. And the next presidential election is 2008, and the next parliamentary election is not until 2010. So they want to extend the presidential term until 2010. It's not clear whether Mugabe would occupy that term himself, although now there are some indications that he might, or that he might appoint a successor, widely believed to be Joyce Mujuru, his current senior vice president, as president in his stead. What happens after? Economically, the infrastructure is badly damaged in Zimbabwe, particularly industrial infrastructure. That being said, I think there are a number of opportunistic foreign and perhaps local investors who can make a silk purse out of a sow's ear and reconstitute much of the economic infrastructure relatively quickly. Politically, the institutions are badly damaged, and it's not clear what happens, whether or not Mujuru becomes Mugabe's successor or not, whether there's a power struggle, what the role of the military is going to be going forward, which has become an extremely powerful institution just in the last few years and very influential in policy making. Will the rule of law be respected post-Mugabe? Hard to say. It's been completely decimated under Mugabe in the last 6 years. So I'm not very optimistic in the short term, whether Mugabe's there or not, about what happens politically within Zimbabwe. I think it's going to be a period of great contestation and quite a bit of struggle.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. Our guest is Scott Taylor. He's professor at Georgetown University, assistant professor in the African Studies program of the Walsh School of Foreign Service. We're talking about Zimbabwe. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the economy of the country is in very, very bad shape. Extraordinarily high unemployment. Inflation over 1,000%. I read that I think this year that the mint in Zimbabwe issued a new note, a $100,000 note, which I'm not sure what that would be worth in U.S. dollars, a dollar maybe,
a couple of dollars? On the street, it's right as of the beginning of July on the street, that's worth about 20 cents.
20 cents.
Yeah.
Okay. So things are very, very bad. And so you wonder how it is that most people, average people, certainly people who are on the lower end of having things, how people manage to live.
Life has become untenable for so many Zimbabweans, particularly in the urban areas, where those in the rural areas might have, you know, a small plot or a shamba or something where they can farm a little bit and eke out a subsistence. As you say, with 80%+ unemployment, 85% poverty rate, HIV, AIDS infecting around 20-25% of the adult population, the healthcare infrastructure has collapsed. There are chronic food shortages because of price controls has meant that it's not worth producers to produce to grow and produce food in many cases and manufacture it. Foreign currency is scarce, so the importing of non-relief food and other products is prohibitively expensive. So, you know, gasoline is unaffordable. you know, I mean, it's become a struggle for many Zimbabweans to stay alive, and what you have is sort of the regime tries to put a veneer on this that, you know, everything is fine, but obviously if you look within Zimbabwe, it certainly isn't. The question is, you know, some analysts say, well, that's sort of the recipe for revolution with people this, you know, in this much trouble. And I would disagree with that, actually, because people are just concerned with survival at this point, with eking out, you know, daily existence.
Now, I just came across just another remarkable statistic just to show how bad things are. And apparently, according to the report from the World Health Organization, the average life expectancy for a Zimbabwean man now is 37, and for women it is 34. That's the shortest, lowest life expectancy in the world of any place. And, you know, for that reason, reasons like that and the reasons that things are so bad, I think one of the other things that has happened is that a lot of people, that people who could leave have left the country.
Yeah, I mean, you've got... nobody knows exactly how many Zimbabweans have left of a population that estimated about 13 million now. It's believed that at least 2 million are now outside the country. And I've heard the figure as high as 2 million in South Africa alone. So if you spread it out to other countries in the region and the UK and Europe, where many of the professionals have gone, the number is probably far higher than even 2 million. But in that also lies the seeds of the answer to your previous question, which is remittances. Many people in Zimbabwe today are able to survive precisely because that 2 or 3 million odd Zimbabweans is living outside the country and able to send some money back to family and to extended family in Zimbabwe to allow them to, you know, to make it on a day-to-day basis.
The government, and Mr. Mugabe particularly, because he represents the government, he is sort of the most visible representative, has gotten a great deal of criticism from leaders around Africa and also from outside, from Britain, from the U.S., from Australia, from Europe. And at the same time, also, there have been a lot of offers of various kinds of assistance, which I think generally Mr. Mugabe has rejected.
Yeah.
What is there anything constructive now that that Europe, Britain, the United States, the United Nations, anybody could be able to do?
Well, I mean, you put your finger on it, and various initiatives have been undertaken. The South Africans, who have arguably the most at stake here, both economically and in terms of being neighbor to Zimbabwe politically, they have been criticized for not taking enough action, but the President Mbeki in South Africa did try to convene to reach an agreement between the MDC and ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe that didn't succeed about a year and a half ago. Now overtures have been made by the UN. Kofi Annan has sort of anointed the former president of Tanzania, Benjamin Mkapa, to try to be essentially an envoy to try to resolve the Zimbabwe crisis. But as you say, the resistance, Mugabe is intransigent and has, you know, rebuffed all efforts to try to engage, you know, from outside, engage with the problem. And it has to be on his terms, on ZANU-PF terms. But those terms are always shifting, so it's not really clear what at this point the external community could do. I mean, Britain thought that and the Commonwealth thought that sort of condemning the ZANU-PF government through the Commonwealth was the answer, and Mugabe sort of preempted that by withdrawing from the Commonwealth. You know, the Southern African Development Community, SADC, has tried a number of initiatives, and those have kind of fallen short. The IMF threatened to withdraw Zimbabwe's membership, and they met the arrears this year by printing something like $230 million worth of new currency. currency, thus blowing up the inflation rate even higher. So, I mean, there doesn't seem that the U.S. engages in these targeted sanctions of, I think it's now 28 people are barred from traveling or investing in the U.S. and accounts are frozen, and 33 institutions in the EU. It's a similar figure. But these have largely been ineffective as well. So what can the international community do? It's unclear to me. I would have said, if you'd asked me that question, 2 years ago, I would have said greater engagement by South Africa and by Mugabe's regional and African partners. That's been tried with very little effect. So it seems that the end game in Zimbabwe has to be, or will be, an internal one, and then the outside world, including the neighbors of Zimbabwe, will have to come in and clean up the mess afterward.
Yeah. There certainly are other places in Africa that have suffered from poor leadership, have also have dealt with some of the same kind of challenges of that Zimbabwe does, although Zimbabwe seems to be in many ways worse than a lot of places. When you look at Zimbabwe and what's going on there today, would one say that this is representative of a host of African problems that other countries face, or is it indeed a special case, and is this not so much about Africa as it is really about Zimbabwe?
That's a great question. I would say that it is that it's not representative of Africa as a whole, although there are certainly other countries in Africa that are currently suffering and historically have suffered from bad leadership and misgovernance. But Zimbabwe itself is a peculiar combination of this the colonial regime, the inequities in land and business ownership and so on that post-dated the independence movement and the independence of the country in 1980. It was in a very bad neighborhood in terms of South Africa, in terms of the frontline state, until the end of apartheid in South Africa. And there was, war in Mozambique, and it was involved in that as well. So, this confluence of factors contributed to, and as you said at the beginning, Mugabe's personality and the personal factors as well certainly play a role. But I don't think you look at Zimbabwe and say, that's representative of Africa at all, because you can look at any number of success stories in Africa and any number of examples of excellent leadership. But it is a problem that certainly affects the rest of Africa, because the longer this stays unresolved, the more it makes neighboring leaders like Mbeki in South Africa, like Mohai in Botswana, and others who have increasingly become critical of Mugabe, it makes them seem like their influence, both regionally and continentally in Africa, is not what they would like it to be and what they profess it to be. And Mugabe is a drag on the African Union. Mugabe is a drag on the new Partnership for Africa's Development, the sort of major economic and political thrust that emerged from the African Union discussions. So, the short answer is it's got to be resolved for the benefit of all of those issues, but we shouldn't look at Zimbabwe as necessarily representative of the African continent as a whole. Mm.
Well, it certainly seems that at least here in for the foreseeable future, there isn't much to be encouraged about. It doesn't seem to be that from outside there's anybody who is much in a position to have much leverage over the government. That within the country, they have the ability to step on the opposition so that it's difficult for there to be any sort of political opposition. And as far as an awful lot of Zimbabweans are concerned, there are people who can get out leave, and people who don't are they're all of their energy is consumed with simply surviving. It doesn't give one the feeling that anything is likely to change anytime very soon, and certainly it's not likely to get better, and maybe indeed likely to get worse.
Well, I would think so, and I hate having to say that. The only leverage I think that external actors might have at this point is for South Africa and Mozambique and others who are supplying power, or the Chinese who are increasingly interested in Zimbabwean mineral exploitation, that they basically shut out the lights, and that it would be enormously controversial and also very destructive for, you know, the average, the 10, 11 million Zimbabweans who are still in the country. So it's a very difficult, you know, there are no easy external solutions, certainly. And as I said, the internal endgame has yet to play out. I think we're going to see Mugabe. I would suspect that he'll stay at least until 2010, and that we're going to see, even when he does go, a power struggle, regardless of whether it's settled constitutionally, that I think that one will emerge anyway after Mugabe steps down or meets his end.
Well, there we must stop. We've come to the end of the time. I want to say thanks to our guest, Scott Taylor. He's a professor, assistant professor in the African Studies program of the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. Professor Taylor, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay.
Our program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Well, speaking of food, here's some food for thought. The quality of our lives depends in part on our knowledge about cooking and eating. That thought comes from Charles Baker Clark, author of the book Profiles from the Kitchen, What Great Cooks Have Taught Us About Ourselves and Our Food. While urging us to rethink our relationship to food, Baker Clark also celebrates cooks and their dedication to the craft of cooking. He will be talking with Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour of the show today. The program itself gets underway at noon here on AM 580. In the next hour of this show, we'll be talking about jazz, and particularly about the history of Impulse Records, that label, and its relationship with jazz great John Coltrane. We'll talk with music journalist Ashley Kahn in the next hour. First, though, we'll break for an update on news and the market, so stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois.